But to begin, my first guest is no stranger to controversy. Heavens above, did I say that? It's one of the greatest understatements I've ever said on the program. Geoffrey Blainey has spent most of his long and distinguished life provoking the history wars. Well-publicised comments on the dangers of immigration, Asian immigration, caused appropriate kerfuffle, as did Geoff's complaints about black armband history, but nothing can gainsay the fact that he's one of our preeminent historians. Though a professor of history, Geoff's largely chosen to ignore academia and has made his living writing quite remarkable and provocative books on history. On the back of the latest, says he's written over 40 of them, from the classic Tyranny of Distance to a best-selling short history of the world. Back in 2003, he was on LNL talking about the role of moonlight in a vanished Australia, the wonderful soft and nocturnal light that made so much of rural life possible and even influenced the behaviour of bushrangers. His latest is called The Story of Australia's People, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Australia. And Geoffrey joined me from our Melbourne studio.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you very much.
You've made a comment in a recent article about your book that you see parts of history with fresh eyes. Tell me what you think is the most important part of Australia's history that you now seek to refresh.
Well, in 1975, I wrote a book called Triumph of the Nomads, which was a history of Aboriginal Australia, and I came back to it a couple of years ago, and I thought, what an incredible amount of research has been done in this field, what a lot of new discoveries, but I thought I'm beginning to see evidence in a slightly different way, so that the new book is a combination of new research by archaeologists and anthropologists and other people, and also, I suppose, of my own ageing or changing views, whatever.
You wrote recently, Geoffrey, that history is strewn with minefields. What are the minefields in this book?
The minefields, well, I suppose in Aboriginal history, the biggest minefield is that as an academic study, it's so new. In 1956, I went to only the second archaeological excavation ever carried out in Australia, and at that time, people wondered whether Aborigines had been here 2,000 years or 3,000 years, and now people are talking about 50,000 with almost complete confidence. Many say it's 60 or well over 60. Well, when you fill in a gap as wide as that with new knowledge, you realise the minefields there were in the past when you had virtually no knowledge.
Let's go from minefields to rising waters, because as you point out, the great rising of the seas profoundly affected the lives and culture of Aboriginal Australians. Tell us about that.
I think this is the great event in Australian history. Captain Cook, Governor Phillip, the creation of the Commonwealth, they're nothing compared to this event witnessed by Aborigines generation after generation. About 17,000 years ago, the sea began to rise all over the world. And if you lived as many Aborigines did around Melbourne or Sydney at that time, you could walk to Port Moresby. There was no Torres Strait. You could walk to Hobart. There was no Bass Strait. Every present capital city in mainland on the coast of Australia was considerable distance from the sea. Now they're virtually all ports, so that the map was completely reshaped in the presence of Aborigines living generation after generation, and some say one-seventh, others say maybe as much as one-quarter of Australia was simply drowned by the seas. And you could almost call that one of the minefields, because so much of the early history of Australia has therefore been buried under the seas, including the place where Australia was first discovered by the people who came down from somewhere in Southeast Asia. But that event had profound consequences. Of course, it was accompanied by climate change of a huge scale. The land became more productive, the seasons were longer. Many people had lost all their tribal lands, all their homelands, and had to move somewhere else. It must have been a chaotic period, and I suppose you could say it's a tribute to the Aboriginal people in their spirit that they survived it and lived to fight another day in what was really a new landscape.
One of the controversial issues that you haven't refreshed from Triumph of the Nomads is infanticide amongst Indigenous tribes. You write that it was practiced throughout society and probably in every nomadic society. What's the evidence for that, Geoffrey?
Well, the evidence is I think, much stronger than when I first wrote the book in 1975. The protectors of Aborigines, who mostly were very sympathetic to the Aborigines and kept very good records, they record again and again the practice of mothers of killing infants. I mean, I don't in any way blame people for doing this. If you are a society that's often on the move, you can't carry around a swag of infants if you're breastfeeding them for 3 or 4 years. One's enough. The evidence is quite large, but a considerable number of people are not happy with the evidence, and they say, well, you know, perhaps they only did it when they were in distress under, you know, conditions of invasion. But the general opinion of people who've studied nomadic societies in other parts of the world was this was something that was part of their life, and that was it.
But Geoffrey, you do accept that many of your colleagues in the history business would dispute this strongly.
Well, I think they wouldn't dispute it so strongly when they've seen some of the new evidence I have in this new edition. For example, the protector of Aborigines at Port Phillip when Melbourne was first settled and highly disposed towards them reported again and again in the killing of infants. Maybe a week old, maybe 2 weeks old, and the fact that in many ways there was no alternative to it. So that, you know, like many questions, people will debate about the evidence, but I think it's a fairly strong case.
A lot of the evidence relates to the journals of William Thomas, who was an early 19th century protector of the Aborigines in Victoria, but I understand that even he had his doubts. He said that he lacked ocular evidence.
Yes, a book has been published in the last 2 or 3 years based on his journals, and I think he found quite a lot of evidence in the 1840s when the Aboriginal group that possessed most of the territory around Port Phillip Bay, Western Port, and well down towards Wilson's Promontory when they were in trouble, and he records it again and again, and he says that that group at one stage had no child under the age of 6. In other words, children were still being born, but they were vanishing, and that's his explanation.
Geoffrey, another minefield, of course, is the subject of frontier conflict, military campaigns, and who or what was responsible for the number of Indigenous deaths. Your view has been summarised thus: Blaney does not subscribe to the now widespread view that Aborigines lived in remarkable harmony with their environment and with each other. They were modern human beings with the capacity not only to invent, but to destroy and wage war. And you seem to, what, you imply that the rivalry between Aboriginal tribes was very significant in Indigenous deaths, rather than the battles between tribes, settlers and colonial troops.
I think they were both significant. The very large numbers of deaths in areas where the Europeans had penetrated, but large numbers of deaths in areas where two Aboriginal groups were living side by side. I wouldn't say that Aborigines were innately warlike. I wouldn't say any people were innately warlike, but I think one of the problems of their society was that they had large numbers of groups, you know, with maybe 500 or 1,000 or 1,500 people, and no group was really large enough to conquer permanently another group, so that you know, the rivalry and the hostilities went on and on. I think once you have a powerful society, let's say like the ancient Egyptians or Mesopotamians, they've got professional armies and you can defeat virtually anybody except a strong power that might be.
Well, that takes us to what you say about one of the weaknesses of indigenous society being a lack of cooperation between the tribes in repulsing the invasion of their lands.
Yes. I think if they had strong alliances with tribes or nations, is a word they often like to use now, if they had alliances with nations round about, they probably would have repelled the first Europeans who landed at Sydney Cove and even at other places. But the Aborigines were divided and didn't cooperate easily. I think your first chance of repelling an invader is when the invader doesn't know the terrain, doesn't know the climate, doesn't know the coast properly, and is extremely vulnerable to the people whose homeland it is. But I think the Aborigines, by and large, lost their chance because they were divided. They saw their rival nation as much their rival and their enemy as the people who came in naval and military uniforms.
You have a chapter in the book called The War on the Grasslands, and it's about the conflict in southern Queensland. And there's some evidence of, in these battles, of intertribal cooperation and military strategy on the part of different tribes.
Yes. I think there's more evidence in Queensland, which of course is very late in the story, than you can find in Victoria and New South Wales. And I've recently read Henry Reynolds' book. Is it called The Forgotten War? And he talks about the cooperation there. But on the other hand, the cooperation doesn't extend to those Aborigines who preferred to serve in the Queensland Native Police or Mounted Police and, in effect, fight their own kinsfolk. You know, one of the problems in Queensland is that there's no unity amongst Aborigines, and a sizable proportion, some say one-third of the deaths of Aborigines in the fighting or the skirmishes in Queensland are caused by the Mounted Police, who, of course, were overwhelmingly Aboriginal people. So that even in Queensland, you don't see the level of cooperation that you might expect.
Let's look at this issue of fighting between the groups, the tribes, that some called the nations. Leichhardt found that in indigenous battles, people were rarely killed, but often wounded, and also witnessed that extermination battles are completely lacking. Mm. In other words, it was a low-violence strategy.
Yes. That was widely said, whether Leichhardt was the source of that belief amongst prehistorians and anthropologists of 50 years ago, but when I started doing research in this field in the 1970s, I noticed that many of the most talented people in the field said yes, they did fight, but the casualties were slight and perhaps only one person was killed and that was all. But I then thought, well, if in a tiny population a person is killed every year or every 6 months through fighting, let's work out the proportion of the population that is. And once you see casualties like that in a relatively small population, you realise that the effect on a population that is small can be very substantial indeed. And when I first investigated this in the 1970s, I couldn't find any evidence of more than a few people being killed in any one episode or one battle. But since then, I've found evidence of up to 60 or 70 people being killed in the one lightning raid or the one battle, something that I don't think has been noticed before. Now, I don't know how often there were large-scale killings when Aborigines met Aborigines, but that was something that wasn't realised by the people who took Leichhardt's word.
Geoffrey, it would have been good had the violence against Indigenous groups been low violence, but that wasn't the case, was it?
No,
there was
it wasn't,
a great amount of quite vengeful vigilante killing and the odd officially sanctioned massacre.
Yes. Some of it was officially sanctioned. Relatively few people were tried in the whole history of the 19th century in Australia for killing Aborigines. There was a famous episode in New South Wales in 1838 where I think it was that 8 men were tried and at first were not convicted, but eventually were convicted. That was really a most unusual event. Generally, people could kill an Aboriginal with impunity and Aborigines could kill each other with impunity in that period.
Ellie Nell on RN Summer, my guest, Professor Geoffrey Blainey. Geoffrey,
yes,
I introduced you by talking about your role in the history wars, but you think it's an exaggeration to label discussions about Indigenous history thus, don't you?
Yes, I think it's too strong a phrase. In all kinds of intellectual activity, there's conflict, and you don't make a major discovery in science or the social sciences or the humanities without conflict, because after all, a strongly held position is in the end overthrown, and that's not very pleasant to the people who've defended it for a long period of time. So I think, you know, conflict and debate is inevitable in all kinds of human activities, and it's not surprising that it's in history. After all, it's strong in meteorology, isn't it, in biology, in many branches of medicine. It's just part of the process of learning.
Geoffrey, you don't think you sometimes stoke the conflict by dismissing a lot of alternative views as being too romantic, too sentimental?
Well, it's possible. Of course, I'm a human being, and as you say, I may be a stoker, but I certainly don't try to stoke, and I try to look at these things.
Well, you're certainly more a stoker than a stroker, Geoffrey.
Go on. I'm astonished.
Okay. I want to quote something of yours here, because I find it interesting. Present-day politicians, judges, historians, clergymen, even Indigenous leaders assume that if they were in Governor Phillips' boots in 1788, they themselves would have solved the conflict. You say, I think none of us could have solved it.
No.
But
no,
you think that there's a fair chance of a solution if we read our history?
Well, I think there's more chance of a solution if we read our history. My view, and you've quoted it, Bethley, is that in 1788, even if the wisest people from the British Isles had landed, and even if by chance the wisest people from all over Australia were there to meet them or to look at them, that there was no way that first generation could find a workable solution. Their views on so many matters were so far apart. I think that each side has learnt a surprising amount about the other side through trial and error in the last 200 years, and a well-educated European knows much more than used to be known about Aboriginal ways and activities and attitudes and possessions. And likewise, I'm sure that Aborigines know far more than their ancestral leaders would have known in 1788 or 1838. And this seems to me to be one of the problems when people talk about the Aboriginal homelands, the new settlements, where probably 80,000 Aborigines live at present, and often in very difficult and simple conditions. I think there's more understanding of that question on both sides than there possibly could have been 50 or 100 years ago. Maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think there is more understanding.
As I said, my guest has written over 40 books on Australian history, from the classic Tyranny of Distance, Triumph of the Nomads, to his new book, The Story of Australia's People, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Australia. Thank you, Geoffrey Blainey. Talk to you again.
Thank you, Philip. Good to talk.